things, then you can let someone else do it. That's also a type of management when it comes to your affairs, that you have to put them in order. When it comes to matters that are important, matters that are sensitive, matters that requires your direct attention, you do it yourself. Don't let someone else do it for you. With the small matters, you can. This is also a type of management in one's affairs. Also, we see the Imam alayhi salam says, when it comes to seeking wealth and making money, he says, when it comes to you seeking wealth, make sure it is, does not go above those who just wants to be greedy and not below those who just waste money. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program The Keys of Life, and we're talking about key number 3, and that is to have a management and time management, affair management, and everything in between. Because without this kind of management, nothing will be in the right place. Nothing will work accordingly. And one of the problems that we face in our current modern time is, in fact, management of our own affairs. We live in a world where we are constantly distracted. It's a world of distraction. We are constantly, our minds are absent. We are constantly unaware of what's happening around us. We are constantly being run by Big Brother, someone behind the screen. They control what we do. They control what we see. They control what we spend. In the sense, not obviously directly, but trying to manipulate your mind. You're working day and night. You're trying to earn for your family. But then advertisement and the media is doing an impressive job, I gotta admit, in trying to subconsciously make people waste their money and put it in the wrong places. Meaning, there is no longer management when it comes to one's affairs. Even when it comes to even not only matters of money, even social matters, family matters, dealing with other people, we can see that we are literally being brainwashed and we act according to what we've been told subconsciously. And that's a big problem. And that's why you see most people these days, when it comes to their life, there is no sense of management whatsoever. That their life is a chaos. Their life is just random. Their life either full of boredom, nothing to do, laziness, unemployment, and everything in between, or you see their life is chaotic in the sense they do two jobs at a day, three jobs at a day, working overtime, working night shift, and in the process, there's a neglect towards their families, a neglect towards their kids, a neglect towards everything else. Where one could work less and could do less job and spend more time with their kids, more time in their houses, more time with their spouses, considering that they have very well-run management. Without that kind of management, then your life will crumble. Your life will fall apart. As simple as that. Then people themselves will lose purpose. They will lose even, you know, to forget what makes them move, what makes them tick. When you have no aim, then you are not aiming for something at all. Therefore, if we go back to the Quran, if we back to the Hadith, we see the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam constantly informing me and you that we should always have management. Manage our days, put a schedule, put a roster, and do the right thing. When it comes to wealth, make sure it goes in the right places. Nothing should be left to chance. That is not the life of a believer. We'll leave it here, and inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, take care of yourselves. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
The Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد اللي هديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, you know, since we are talking about the, you know, some of the Islamic laws about medical issues, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. Is it permissible for the women to use contraceptives without the, you know, her husband's permission?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, using contraceptives without the permission of the husband is problematic. It is a matter of objection. And therefore, she needs the consent and permission of her husband, in order to use the contraceptives.
Mm-hmm. I see. The next question that I would like to ask you, Sheikh Shavit, is about the vasectomy. This is one of those operations that, men would go under knife about. And a man, for example, with four children, underwent one of these operations, vasectomy, without the consent of his wife. Is there any need actually for the husband to take the permission from his wife? Is he guilty for not obtaining his wife's approval?
Well, generally speaking, the permissibility of going under an operation of vasectomy does not depend on the consent of the wife. Mm-hmm. And therefore, a man can go ahead using the vasectomy as a contraceptive to avoid impregnating his wife or avoid having further children, because he has already got four children, and of course he can stop at any moment having any more children. And of course, one of the methods one of the contraceptive methods is vasectomy, which a man can choose to have at any time without even getting his wife's approval.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and the next question I would like to ask you, Sheikh Javid, is about, some of these methods of contraceptives that we started talking about, and by saying, for example, or asking you a question about the vasectomy, is it permissible for a healthy woman for whom pregnancy is not harmful, all right?
Yes.
To use any of the contraceptives such as coitus interruptus, the diaphragm, the pill, and the sterilization. So is it permissible for a healthy woman, in fact, to use any of these methods of contraceptives? And also, is it permissible for the husband to force to make his wife actually use any method other than the coitus interruptus?
Well, in itself speaking, there is no problem in doing contraception by way of coitus interruptus. Generally speaking, it is permissible for a woman to use all kinds of contraceptives, all methods of contraception. As we said earlier, the husband's consent is very important.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to a healthy woman for whom, of course, pregnancy is not harmful, she can use contraceptives. And, of course, both the husband and the wife can use contraceptives, one of the methods of contraception or one of the contraceptive methods is coitus interruptus,
mm-hmm.
which means that the man ejaculates outside the vagina, and that is, of course, a practice that used to exist long time ago in the early period of Islam, because there are questions as to whether this practice of contraception is allowed or not, and was it ever practiced during the time of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, or not. Of course, there are narrations, authentic traditions, which quite clearly suggest that this action and this method of this contraceptive method is quite permissible. And of course, there's no objection also to resorting to any other method apart from this coitus interruptus. All kinds of methods are allowed, provided that it is not harmful, and it is reversible. That's also very much important for you know, there are couples that are childless couples.
Yeah.
And of course, in the long run, if they continue to have no children, they will face difficulties, because a childless couple usually end up in separating from each other or getting a divorce, and that will be a huge problem. So the family will disintegrate. Therefore, the religious authorities have clearly stated that the contraceptive must be reversible. Mm-hmm. Reversible. So in any time, at any moment, if one of the parties wants to reverse or get back to the same, to the previous mode, he or she could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, when a woman wants to use contraceptives, it's kind of necessary that she get her husband's consent and permission. And of course, this using contraceptives must not involve any haram action, such as mm-hmm. touching and, of course, looking at the private part. Otherwise, this is not permissible. Of course, when it comes to the last part of your question, because you said that...
Let me interrupt you here, actually, for a short break, and we'll be back for your answer to the next part of my question. Thank you very much. Just to stay with us with the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. This is Mama Jawad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the medical issues according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. So, Sheikh Javid, you were continuing along the same line as the question posed. So, I asked you that, is it permissible for the husband to force his wife, actually, to use any of these methods, such as, or other than the coitus interruptus?
Oh, well, the husband has no right to force his wife to go for any of these contraceptive methods, because it's not within his right to force her to become either pregnant or to stop becoming pregnant.
Mm.
It is a matter of choice.
Yeah, and between the family.
Yeah, and of course the wife can choose not to become pregnant,
right,
or to become pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So the wife and the husband actually has no right to impose his wishes on his wife. That's it.
I see. And you very quickly and briefly mentioned, the questionability of such irreversible methods of contraception. I would like to ask you about the vasectomy. Is it, something illegal? Because it looks like it's irreversible, right?
Yeah, a vasectomy, as far as I know, there are two types of it. It can be reversible, it mm-hmm. can be irreversible. There is a very strong possibility that the tie can be untied,
mm-hmm.
and then the tube, it's a kind of I'm not sure if it's a kind of tube tied with something, and the doctors know better, because they are the ones who
they're specialists.
Yeah, they are the specialists, of course. So some doctors have said that it is irreversible, and others have said that it is not. But in the event that it is reversible,
uh-huh.
Of course, as it is the case, usually the case, they have said, and depending also on the age and, of course, the age of the couple, sometimes it may not be reversible. So in the event that the couples have children,
right.
and it is irreversible, even if they do not have children, then there's no objection to the couple having this any kind of these contraceptives method.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawbid, for your nice answers to the questions. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Tümen. Yani?
Bazaar.
No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation.
Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. This week we will venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on meat production. We will explore this industry's contributions to the national economy.
We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety.
Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety.
For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meat-packing companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, these harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured.
The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy.
First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value. Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security.
We are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy.
To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy.
Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own.
We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. So, the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more.
The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks.
Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate. They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All right, now is the time for me to take a little break here and give the floor to my good friend out in the field who has prepared a report for us.
What What's going on, guys? Well, actually, it's been a while that I've been looking for a practical pair of shoes, and today I decided to come to the first and oldest industrial shoe producer in Iran and the biggest distributor in the Middle East. Looking around, I can see a wide range of shoes in different colors, and this is what makes it difficult for me to choose the right one. To be honest with you guys, I've always been excited to learn more about the manufacturing process of shoes. For this reason, I asked this company to walk me through the production line of footwear. So don't go anywhere, stay with me. I wanted to step right into the factory to see the production line, but I just realized that every little piece has a process here. Now I'm in the designing room, and there's the thing that is called the last of the shoes, and it was really interesting to me to see how the shoes that we wear on a day-to-day basis is turned from to this. Now I'm going to give you an overview of how it is turned into the shoes that we wear. There's tape that is applied on the last, and to draw the design and create the prototype for different collection of shoes. And then it is sent off to stitching section to cut out the pattern on the necessary materials. And we've got different materials, different leather materials with different patterns and different colors. And finally, after the whole thing is approved, it is sent off to the production line. Partly due to the number of pieces used to make one shoe, constructing footwear is a true craft. The pieces needed to make the shoe are cut from high-quality leather, then next in the shoe manufacturing process comes stamping. In the factory, there are various departments that each performs different stages of the production process. When a department has finished their role, the soles are forwarded to the next department in line. Right off from the designing section, they get into the production line, and all the pieces are die-cutted. They are cut into different pieces to finally send them for gluing and stitching to ensure all the pieces are stuck together. All right, now it's time to move to the final section. Shoe manufacturing involves numerous steps to put all the pieces together. Assembling the shoe is the step in the production where the magic happens. Here, all the pieces, including the one that was just sewn, are fitted to form finished shoes. During assembling, the upper is bonded to the outsole. But before this happens, the insole is attached to the last and the upper ridge is placed on the insole to allow the shaft to be stitched to the wet later on and finally give the shoe its final shape. It's simple. It is not as simple as you think. It is such a demanding job. I call this stage the birth of the shoes because the pairs of the shoes are taken off from the mold to finally move on to the final stage, which is trimming. I'm going to give him these shoes, and what he does is cutting out the edges of the shoes to be completely trimmed and sent to the other guy for buffing, waxing, and polishing off the shoes. And finally, they are nice and shiny, and they are ready to be boxed up and shipped out to customers all across the country. Well, what is so significant about this company is the durability and the guarantee of its shoes over time. So for this reason, I was so curious to see what the secret is behind this quality. Now, I'm in the quality control sector to see what happens exactly. All right, what happens here is after the shoes sampling are approved, they are sent off, like different parts of the shoes are sent off from the production sector to the quality control sector. And there are several machines that each of them does is dedicated to a specific style of shoes. For example, formal shoes, athletic shoes, children's shoes. But now, what is so exciting, I'm going to walk you through, or I'm going to draw your attention to the safety shoes. Can you ever imagine a 20-kilogram weight falling in a horrifying manner on your shoes? That is something beyond my imagination. So I want to tell you today that this is the machine. It is called the impact tester that does the same thing. So let's zoom in and see what happens exactly. But of course, it's super horrifying, so I need to keep my distance. Wow, what a sound. You see, it's really, it's like a horror movie, the sounds that I listen, that I hear in the movies. So you need to keep your distance. And since the front of the shoes needs to be fully backed for workers who have demanding jobs in harsh conditions, this machine was created to, form or place this mold in the front of the shoes to protect workers from any sort of damages. So this is really mind-boggling, and it's really a lot to get my mind around. By the end of the day, around 1,400 types of footwear are sold extensively in this company's chain stores. This wide range offers various styles for people of all ages in the society, such as men, women, kids, sports, and as I showed you earlier, safety shoes. After I took a real-life tour into the footwear production world, I gained a broader perspective on how a single pair of shoes is actually made. Wow, for me it was really amusing to take a look at the behind the scenes of shoemaking. And now that I have all those processes in mind, it's time to see if I can find a practical pair of shoes. Alright, now I realize that there are so many factors that play a significant role in choosing a standard pair of shoes, such as the raw material, the comfort, the beauty, the design, and the color. What I appreciate most about this company is the fact that it offers a constellation of footwear in various colors. Shoes for men, women, children, and even safety shoes, as I mentioned earlier. And we've got sandals, slippers, and of course in different quality, we've got leather shoes, linen shoes, and just you name it. Among all of these footwear, I chose this one, which I really loved the way it looks, and the color, and of course the comfort. I gave it a try, and yeah, I'm going home with this pair of shoes. And finally, I found the one that I was looking for. I hope that you got a better understanding of what a pair of shoes goes for before it reaches into your hands. I've been Sarah Dema.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great Imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
Parts of Ziyara texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far. Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. We find that in one of these great debates in which Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was in, of course, just for a little bit of a background, we have these debates in the time of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, and Imam Rida alayhi salam, who was the 8th divinely appointed Imam. The Islamic lands were full of these translations of philosophical and theological and different scientific texts. And so clearly the Muslims began to have new questions about these various subjects. In one such sitting, a person asked Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam about the attributes of Allah. Now, he said, why is our Lord called gentle? And so in response, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said, we call Allah gentle because he knows everything about every tiny thing, even including small insects, and things that are even tinier than insects. Allah knows the position of their organs, their reason, their lust, their copulation, their sympathy with their own descendants, their communications with one another, carrying food to their offsprings, whether they are in the mountains or valleys or deserts. We know that their creator, Allah, is gentle, without manner, because manner is for fashioned creatures. In this beautiful dialogue and this beautiful debate, if you will, between this person who asked Imam al-Jawad the meaning of being gentle, and in response we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam gave a beautiful description of the attributes of Allah, to the point where we learn that Allah knows every single thing, whether small or large. And so when we know that Allah, who is the most caring, the most kind, the most forgiving, the most merciful, the sustainer of everything and the provider of rizq and sustenance, then we begin to truly trust and love Allah, the Almighty. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.